Thanks for joining us on this week's edition of the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. And I'm Brendan, your host for this week's episode. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on social media at Fisheries Pod. If you're the generous sort, you can be like Brian, Jody, Gary, Garrett, Ben, Janet, and John, who support the show on Patreon. Through Patreon, you can make a one-time or recurring donation that helps us pay for various parts of the show. If that's not your thing, you can check out our Teespring store, where you can find Fisheries Pod shirts, hoodies, stickers, and face masks. And with that, let's get on to this week's episode. Joining me today to discuss lampreys and underappreciated fishes is Dr. Margaret Docker. Dr. Docker's research interests include conservation genetics of fishes, particularly lampreys and the underappreciated freshwater fishes in Manitoba, the use of environmental DNA for cost-effective and non-invasive monitoring of aquatic organisms, and the evolution of non-parasitism in lampreys. Since completing your PhD in 1992 under the supervision of Dr. Bill Beamish at the University of Guelph, Margaret has also been trying to understand the mystery of sex determination in lampreys. With funding from the Great Lakes Fisheries Commission and Natural Science and Engineering Research Council of Canada, or NSERC, and collaboration with Drs. Phil Grayson, Colin Garraway, Sarah Good, Allison Wright, and Tamana Yasmin, lamprey sex determination is finally starting to become a little less mysterious. And with that, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today, Margaret.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Awesome. So before we begin talking about lampreys and other underappreciated native fishes, can you tell us where your interest in fisheries first began and how you ended up the head of the Docker Lab?
Yeah, so I think like a lot of us who end up studying fish, our interests sort of start in childhood, that I did a lot of recreational fishing with my dad and my siblings when I grew up in a small town outside of Ottawa, so fishing on the other Mississippi River. So, you know, that and watching a lot of Jacques Cousteau when I was growing up sort of helped develop an interest in fish. I was always interested in biology, and I just found fish so much more diverse and interesting than, say, birds and mammals. So that was sort of where it all started. Yeah. And then in terms of how I ended up, you know, at the University of Manitoba, I'd say maybe a lot of persistence and good luck that I postdoced for 14 and a half years between finishing my PhD and finally landing a faculty position at the University of Manitoba. I think during that time I had 8 moves, including 3 cross-continent moves. So, but during that time, sort of developed, you know, sort of carved out my own niche, combining fundamental research into the evolution and ecology of lampreys with applications to conservation and management.
Wow, that's a lot of moves and a lot of postdocs. Any particular exciting or fun ones you had, or?
Oh, they all were. I mean, they started to, all of the moving started to lose its appeal after about 10 years of that. But I mean that, yeah, no, it was great. I'd say, you know, postdocing in Bob Devlin's lab at the West Vancouver lab of DFO was probably one of the highlights. I spent some time at Pacific Biological Station as well. Yeah, no, a lot of really good moves. Yeah. After 14 and a half years, I was definitely ready to settle down into a permanent position, but it was good.
That's absolutely understandable. So I think what's fun too is your research focus itself on, you know, lamprey, especially some of the ones we'll talk about a little bit later. You know, they're probably one of the most underappreciated native fish in North America. Now, what is it about lampreys that drew you to them?
Yeah, I think I've always sort of been attracted to the underdog and the fact that everybody, you know, would sort of think that they were weird was definitely an appeal. I first got interested, or even I think first introduced to lampreys when I was an undergrad at the University of Guelph. Bill Beamish, who I ended up doing my PhD with, had worked on lampreys for years. I was first interested in sex reversal in coral reef fish. I remember I studied marine biology at the University of Guelph, and I still remember reading a single line in one of my fourth year biology textbooks about how coral reef fish could change sex. And I found that very appealing, not something that's easy to study in Canada. And so then talking to Dr. Beamish, he was talking about some of the research he was beginning that was looking at sex determination in sea lamprey. And the reason why he was looking at sex determination was because there were suggestions that lampreys may have environmental sex determination. So in the Great Lakes, when sea lamprey were at the peak of their abundance in the 1940s, 1950s, sex ratios were strongly male biased, with about 75% of the population being male. And then over the next decade or so, as abundance plummeted following the initiation of sea lamprey control, it shifted to a predominance of females. So there was a suggestion that sex determination might be density dependent. So that sounded quite interesting. That seemed like the closest thing I could do to sex reversal in coral reef fish without leaving Canada. And I also found it very appealing that it had potential applications to sea lamprey control. So when I started my research, sort of my goal was, okay, well, maybe we can use this knowledge to help control these horrible pests in the Great Lakes. Within about 6 months, I'd say that sort of turned to a grudging respect for sea lamprey, how they're able to survive and persevere even through sea lamprey control measures. And then that sort of transitioned even more to sort of complete and utter fascination for these creatures.
The rabbit hole got you.
That's
really cool. And yeah, I think that's something that maybe a lot of people don't know, is that how lamprey have responded to our attempts to control them, which is really unique. And I guess maybe not super unique, because other fish do it, but in the Great Lakes especially, where, you know, or the government of Canada and the United States are investing millions and millions of dollars a year to keep those populations down, any little bit can help, especially if you can potentially skew sex ratios and start getting more males out there. That's super cool.
Yeah. So it's been fun that, especially like early in my career, particularly during those 14 and a half years of postdocing, I certainly had people telling me that I couldn't make a career out of lampreys and I should try doing something else. And so it's very satisfying to see that, yes, indeed, I can make a career out of lampreys. And then what's kind of ironic is they really aren't, and they might be underappreciated in many respects, but they aren't exactly an overlooked group of fishes anymore. I mean, that they're such an important model organism for evolutionary research and even biomedical research, and the research into control of sea lamprey is not insignificant, not to mention more recent efforts to conserve native lampreys. So, I mean, it is nice that I no longer have to justify why in the world I want to work on lampreys.
Well, let's hope some of your haters are still out there listening to the podcast today, Margaret. And so the next question I have for you already mentioned how lampreys are more than just sea lampreys. So I'm going to suggest that most people, when they think of lampreys, they do think about sea lampreys. But how diverse is this group, and how have sea lampreys kind of influenced the discussion around our native lampreys that we have inside the continent?
Yeah, I mean, definitely in North America, or at least sort of central eastern North America, that the only lamprey that people would be familiar with would be the bad lamprey, the invasive sea lamprey in the Great Lakes, which definitely does sort of taint the view of lampreys in general. That isn't shared elsewhere in the world, fortunately. Like the sea lamprey in its native range isn't a pest, so it's found naturally on both sides of the North Atlantic Ocean. When it feeds in the Atlantic Ocean, it's at low densities, feeding on large-bodied fish that can withstand the parasitism without too much distress. So it's not seen as a pest. There are about 45 or so lamprey species worldwide, so not a terribly diverse group compared to most other fishes, but found in temperate regions of both hemispheres. widely appreciated in most parts of the world. Like in Europe, you can get more per pound for lamprey than any other fish. There are municipalities in Spain and Portugal and elsewhere that have lamprey festivals in the spring, and they have lampreys on their coat of arms or postage stamps with lampreys on them. So definitely revered elsewhere. Pacific lamprey on the west coast of North America, long been valued by Native Americans, particularly in the Columbia River Basin. The Maori in New Zealand have long appreciated pouched lamprey. So yeah, we definitely, this part of the world, have a bit of a skewed view towards lampreys, although I think, and I'm hopeful, that even in the Great Lakes that that's changing, that there is recognition with the Great Lakes Fishery Commission, various conservation organizations, that we need to protect the native lampreys while also trying to control the invasive sea lamprey.
That's really cool that there's that appreciation around the world for this fish that historically, I guess not historically, but last 100 years, we've definitely not appreciated. But you said 45 members of species that is millions and millions of years old, right? We're talking about a prehistoric member of a family that doesn't even have a jaw, but there's only 45 left on the entire planet.
Yes, and I think it's probably that they have been very, the lineage has been very persistent, that surviving for hundreds of millions of years through at least four mass extinction events, but they probably haven't been able to radiate out into all sorts of niches, that they have been able to, they're the way I look at it, they're sort of generalist behaviors in many ways. Like sea lamprey, for example, have been known to feed on at least 50 different host fishes, so that they aren't particularly picky. If one host species, declines in abundance, shifts in distribution, the sea lamprey will adapt readily, so that they're flexible in that respect, although they aren't going to radiate out into all sorts of different trophic niches. So they've hung on, and I suspect they will for quite some time, but not necessarily ballooning out into all sorts of new niches.
That kind of non-specialist parasitism, is that pretty unique to this group?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, that there are certainly some parasites that are very specialized, and it's funny. I'm not a parasitologist. I say it's funny because I still remember on my first postdoc with Dick Beamish at the Pacific Biological Station. I think maybe it's a bit of a joke or something. My first month of my postdoc at PBS, he signed me up to give a talk at a parasitologist's meeting. And I certainly was a bit of a fish out of water among all of the, what we typically think of as parasitologists. So I really don't know in terms of, whether that host-parasite relationship, whether it tends to be more specialized. I'm guessing it does, but that sort of flexibility, I think, has sort of stood lampreys in good stead.
Something I was thinking about when you're giving that answer there, it's just something I've never thought about before, how they are very non-specialist and don't really care what they're eating, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, and I think another way in which they're non-specialized that I think has definitely been advantageous is that they don't home to their natal stream. Pacific salmon, as we know, do home to their natal stream, which allows for specialization to particular local habitats, but it's not particularly flexible if, for example, your stream isn't there anymore, or there's a major dam between you and your spawning habitat. And so lampreys find spawning streams by cueing into the pheromones produced by larval lampreys. So it allows them to find streams that are currently good, not necessarily historically good.
Well, yeah, so or if throw up a lamprey barrier all of a sudden, they're like, oh, hey, we can just move a couple blocks away, there's a new house, and we're good to go.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
That's really cool. And so on shifting back kind of to our native lampreys, what kind of ecological benefits are people not thinking about when they think about like the silvers, the chestnuts of the world, these lampreys that are found inside, continental North America?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because we don't often appreciate the important role of lampreys, or often any non economically important sort of species in the environment. So, you know, lampreys, you know, play a very important role in the ecosystem pretty much at all stages of their life cycle. We're most aware of them when they're feeding at the top of the food chain, when they're competing for fish that we want to exploit, but they're important prey for other fish as well, or other vertebrates as well. So like if we start at the during the larval stage, so that as larvae they burrow in the sediment, they're filter feeders largely feeding on algae and detritus, so that they're really important in sort of capturing that energy that's in detritus that's generally not accessible to other fish species, and then sort of turning that into stored biomass in larval tissue that can then be fed on by other animals. And then sort of after metamorphosis, so they undergo that dramatic metamorphosis, and then most of them then will migrate downstream, usually in pulses with high stream discharge. And so there's a lot of animals, say like marine mammals, marine fishes, that essentially just wait by the mouth of the river for these sometimes millions of downstream migrating lampreys to come out. And so that's obviously important prey for those predators. It's also been found that this sort of glut of downstream migrating lampreys can often buffer predation on salmon smolts. That if you didn't have those downstream migrating lampreys, the predation on salmon smolts would be much, much higher. So important in that respect. When they're parasites at sea, or say in the Great Lakes, they tend not to be preyed upon quite as much because they're more dispersed, you know, harder to capture by predators.
But then when they're temporally and spatially concentrated again during their upstream migration, particularly then when they have high lipid reserves for that non-feeding spawning migration, then they're really popular for a number of aquatic, aerial, and even terrestrial predators that feed on them.
And then sort of, and then as a final contribution to the ecosystem, that when they die after spawning, their decomposing carcasses contribute marine-derived nutrients to what are usually fairly nutrient-poor freshwater systems. Oh, and then I can add one more just in case people aren't already convinced that lampreys are important. They've also been identified as being ecosystem engineers, that the larval lampreys in their burrowing behavior, and also that the nest building behavior of the adults has been found to modify the stream environment in ways that benefit other aquatic animals, aquatic insects and other fishes.
Very cool. Speaking of things that have been learned, so shifting back from the realm of ecosystems and water, can you talk about your own PhD work that you did a couple years ago and how that work is being now used and kind of built upon 25 years later?
Yeah. So yeah, this will be maybe a little bit more of a longer answer, but I'll try to, first of all, remember what I did that long ago, and then also sort of bring it into the present with our continued work now. Yeah, so for my PhD, I studied sex differentiation in lampreys, and specifically testing for environmental sex determination, specifically density-dependent sex determination, to see if that explained that shift in sex ratio that I had been talking about earlier, where we saw a shift from male-biased sex ratios to female-biased sex ratios with the initiation of sea lamprey control. So lampreys, well, they have that, as I've just mentioned, that very prolonged larval stage that lasts, 4 to 5 to 7 or more years, and gonadal differentiation is also very sort of prolonged, where the gonad is at least histologically undifferentiated, not recognizable as an ovary or a testis for several years. Ovarian differentiation in sea lamprey starts at about 2 or 3 years of age, but the future testis still doesn't differentiate until basically the end of the larval stage. So future males remain undifferentiated for, you know, 5 years or so, and it's only with the onset of metamorphosis that we get that final testicular differentiation. So the idea then is that during this prolonged period of sexual indeterminacy, the gonad might be susceptible to environmental influence that could then influence the ultimate fate of the gonad. So that's sort of what I wanted to look at. Now, in hindsight, you know, studying such a prolonged process for a graduate degree maybe wasn't the smartest move. It ended up, you know, taking 6.5 years to complete that work. And sadly, it was a little, the results were, you know, somewhat equivocal at the end of all that, that, so that there were sort of like two main parts to my thesis. One was a field study where I looked for correlations between density and sex ratio in another lamprey species, the non-parasitic leastbrook lamprey that's found in the southeastern United States and that's never been exposed to sea lamprey control, to see whether we see the same patterns. And we did indeed see the same patterns, a correlation between larval sex ratio and density, with a higher percentage of males at higher densities. So that supported density-dependent sex determination. But then the more challenging experimental part of the research, where I reared larval sea lamprey under conditions of different densities for 3.5 years to see if I could manipulate sex ratio, that was a little bit more ambiguous. That there was a slight difference, that there were slightly more males at high density compared to low density, but it wasn't statistically significant. And then what was particularly frustrating was that over those 3.5 years, there'd been enough mortality that I couldn't rule out differential mortality between the sexes. And then I think the biggest complication was even the lowest experimental density was still quite high compared to natural densities. My low density was 10 larvae per tank and my high density was 100 larvae per tank, but 10 larvae in a laundry tub was still a fairly high density, but of course I couldn't have one or two per tank and look at sex ratios. So at the end of that, it was still somewhat inconclusive. Wow. And so at that point, and so I finished my PhD thesis in 1992. At that point, it seemed like understanding sex determination in lampreys was a, you know, intractable problem. I didn't have the opportunity to further that work during my postdoc, so I just sort of left it hoping that somebody else would pick up the torch and answer all the questions.
But so you basically were a lamprey mom for 4 years. Was that parenthood practice or?
Yes. I do remember one Christmas day being there tending to my lampreys rather than going home for the holidays. Yeah.
Wow. So that was your work 25 years ago, and now, you know, it's 2024 now. We have all these cool modern genetics techniques. How have modern genetics helped you and the people working on this problem address it? And what have you found?
So it's really exciting now that having sort of given up on me personally being able to answer that question or for it even to be answered, you know, fast forward 25 years later. And as you said, sort of with the advent now of new genomics methods, funding from the Great Lakes Fishery Commission, collaborative efforts of several very talented colleagues who have genomics and bioinformatics expertise that I myself lack. I think you mentioned them at the beginning: Colin Garraway, Sarah Good, Phil Grayson, Allison Wright, and Tamina Yasmin in particular. And I think, yeah, that we might finally now, after a long drought, be on the verge of maybe understanding sex determination in lampreys. So I can sort of describe the sort of two-pronged approach that we've been using and the advances that we've made over the past few years. So we started by sequencing the whole genome of over 200 sea lamprey, males and females, to see if we could find any consistent differences between males and females. Previous studies using lower resolution methods didn't find any differences. But with these lower resolution methods, the differences would have to be pretty dramatic to have been able to see them. Subtle differences wouldn't have been evident. So, for example, I mean, one of the easiest ways to sort of sex a lot of animals, birds and mammals in particular, is, of course, to look for sex chromosomes, where you have all of the sex sex-determining genes concentrated on a single chromosome, to the point that you get size differences, and all you've got to do is look at a chromosome smear and pick out those heteromorphic sex chromosomes. Lampreys don't have obvious heteromorphic sex chromosomes, probably not surprisingly, because lampreys have the largest number of chromosomes of any vertebrate, about 180, and they're the smallest of any vertebrate. And so, you know, trying to do a chromosome smear and pick out those X and Y chromosomes would, of course, be
180.
Impossible.
That's a lot.
It's a lot. Yeah.
Is that something that's this is maybe a silly question, but is that something common in fishes that are considered prehistoric, or is that a lamprey specific thing?
I don't know if it's common in other fishes, and I wouldn't even say that it's lamprey specific, because there's one family of southern hemisphere lampreys that has half that number.
Outlier.
And so definitely no recognizable sex chromosomes. So based on work in other fishes where, you know, sometimes you have heteromorphic sex chromosomes in some other fish, most notably the tiger puffer fish, there seems to be a single nucleotide difference that distinguishes males from females. So going on the assumption then, if lampreys have a genetic basis of sex, then it would be subtle, then that's when we took the whole genome approach. So we did whole genome sequencing on more than 200 sea lamprey on DNA from sea lamprey fin clips. Phil Grayson, you know, conducted some pretty amazing bioinformatic analyses and found not a single nucleotide difference between males and females. Now, one of the things that was really nice about the work that he did was he developed this sort of pipeline that used tiger puffer fish to test to see whether or not this bioinformatic analysis would find even subtle differences if they were there, and they found definitively found for the tiger puffer fish with that one nucleotide difference between males and females. So at least we were confident now that we were at least able to unambiguously say there are no sex-specific differences between males and females in the somatic genome. So at least it was no longer a question of, well, maybe we just didn't look hard enough. Now, the next step, though, is that I've been trying to emphasize that we were talking about the somatic genome and we were looking at DNA that we got from fin clips, because it wasn't so much that we didn't look hard enough now, but rather maybe we weren't looking in the right place. And so just to sort of bring up sort of another weirdness of lampreys, that lampreys are unusual, not unique. There are other animals that do this, but they're unusual in that they undergo what's called a programmed genome rearrangement during early embryonic development, where approximately 20% of the genome is jettisoned from somatic cells during early embryonic development. The full genome is retained. This is the full genome, called the germline genome, is retained only in the germ cells, the future eggs and sperm. And this program, Genome Rearrangement, has been studied by Jeremiah Smith at the University of Kentucky. And because this sort of additional 20% of the genome is ejected from the somatic cells at about 3 to 5 days of embryonic development, the suggestion has been that these extra genes are involved in early embryonic development, that they're used during those first 3 to 5 days, then ejected from the rest of the cells, and then retained only in the germ cells for transmission to the next generation. However, because they're retained in the germ cells, retained in the gonad, that they might also hold the key to sex differentiation as well. And so this was the second part of the project then, mostly led by Sarah Good, Tamina Yasmin, and Phil Grayson, where rather than taking a genomics approach, we took a transcriptomics approach, sequencing all of the genes that are expressed in the gonad of sea lamprey during different developmental stages to get a sense of what genes are expressed in future males and future females at different stages of development. And it was really exciting. We found that there were over 600 germline specific genes that were highly expressed in males, including prospective males that in the future would be males, but not in females. And looking at the function of a lot of these genes in other vertebrates, a lot of these genes are indeed tied to sex determination, sex differentiation in other vertebrates. So the conclusion then was that it's the germline specific region of the genome that is involved in sex differentiation in lampreys, specifically testicular differentiation, with the idea being that if those genes are silenced, the sort of default condition would be an ovary. But if those genes are activated, it would result in testicular differentiation.
That's so cool. So do you feel like closure's coming on this 25-year-old problem you've got?
I think so. And in fact, we now have sort of funding for phase two of the project from the Great Lakes Fishery Commission. Sarah Good is leading this part of it and to further investigate the role of the germline specific region, including possible sort of epigenetic control that would help potentially explain how the environment and the genome can work in concert to determine sex. So yeah, we're optimistic that, that there might be solutions in sight. Yeah.
Sweet. So the obvious use of something like this might be for helping to control sea lamprey in the Great Lakes and where they're impacting fisheries that we're going to start protecting. But we have a number of species at risk in Canada. So they're listed under the Committee for, COSIWIC, so the Committee on Status of Endangered Wildlife in Canada, as being special concern. Is something like this helpful for potentially recovering those species or building management plans? Or how can we use this to assist in native species recovery?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good point. I've mostly been thinking of it from a control point of view, that how the work that we're doing is helping to identify potential targets for manipulation, for genetic control. That's something that's being used in other pest species like malaria carrying mosquitoes, where you can essentially breed females out of existence by manipulating those sex determining genes. From a conservation point of view, I mean, one of the things that would be is valuable potentially is, like, if, for example, there is a significant environmental component to sex determination, we could be, in some of our species of conservation concern, ending up with some fairly skewed sex ratios, especially if it's male biased. If the idea is to breed females out of existence to control invasive sea lamprey if we're doing unintentionally doing the same thing with manipulating environmental conditions with native species of conservation control. This is the sort of knowledge that could perhaps help to reverse that, either by manipulating the environmental conditions so that you can sort of restore more equal sex ratios. I think that would be very valuable.
Very cool. So that's a bunch of work you've got going on, but what else is the Docker Lab up to at the University of Manitoba?
Oh yeah, I mean, a lot of different things. There's, you know, maybe if I sort of divide my research program into, say, three or four prongs, one of the things that we work on is we use environmental DNA to help detect or map the distribution of aquatic species, either species of conservation concern or aquatic invasive species. I mean, environmental DNA, of course, is really useful as a early warning system for detecting aquatic invasive species at the sort of early stages of invasion. So that work started, as most things in my lab do, with research on lampreys using eDNA to detect sea lamprey in tributaries. But now we've branched out to include a number of native lamprey species, but then also other sort of underappreciated freshwater fishes, ones that eDNA might be the most cost-effective way of mapping their distribution. So carmine shiner, bigmouth buffalo, golden red horse, several others. We're also doing some eDNA work on lake sturgeon. So they certainly don't fall into the underappreciated native fishes category, but one that definitely has a lot of conservation and management interest. And then along with some of the work that we're doing locally to use eDNA to map fish distribution, I'm also part of a large Genome Canada initiative, GenFish, where we're developing and validating eDNA assays for all freshwater fishes of Canada so that these then can be used by others who want to monitor these species. That's sort of one prong. And then in terms of some of the other sea lamprey genomics work that I'm doing, again, collaborating with Colin Garraway and Yana Servalli, in addition to the sea lamprey, the sex determination work, we're also using those whole genomes, including an additional 100 or so sea lamprey from outside of the Great Lakes, so that we have whole genomes now for over 300 individuals from throughout their entire invasive and native range, trying to answer such questions as, you know, trying to look at the demographic, you know, history of sea lamprey in the Great Lakes, testing for contemporary gene flow between the Great Lakes and the Atlantic. I mean, you can't even think about genetic control in the Great Lakes if those gene constructs are likely to leak out into the Atlantic, and then also looking for evidence of selection at the level of the genome in Great Lakes sea lamprey compared to the anadromous population. So in particular, things that might be related to freshwater residency or lampricide resistance. And so Yanis has been leading that effort. I think he'll have three pretty exciting papers on those three topics coming out within the next year or so. And then, very briefly, another initiative that I'm part of, we affectionately call it SLAP, the Sea Lamprey Aquaculture and Procurement Project, where you might not think that you actually need to worry about culturing sea lamprey when they're such an abundant pest, but in many ways, the sea lamprey control program, I think, has become a victim of its own success, in that research on later stages of the sea lamprey life cycle are difficult to do because the goal of the sea lamprey control program is to kill them as large larvae so they don't transform into parasitic juveniles. So we're working on trying to culture sea lamprey. So the work to improve survival and growth is being led by John Hume and an amazing team at the Hammond Bay Biological Station in northern Michigan. And then our role here in Manitoba is mostly to be looking at gonadal development and gene expression to make sure that cultured lampreys indeed are good proxies for wild lampreys. If you mess up their development, if, for example, you make them all males by culturing them at high density in the lab, then they aren't very good proxies for.
Yeah, it makes sense how the work about sex determination is now influencing your SLAP project. That's really cool, seeing all those pieces come together. And I'm also happy to hear that you're not going to be a lamprey mom again and just be doing the testing on them. So that's good news for you, I think.
Yeah.
Sweet. So, and speaking of other stuff you've got going on, so shifting gears a little bit here to talk about the Environmental Biology of Fishes Journal. So there's a special issue on underappreciated fishes in North America and their management coming out. And yourself and six other editors are working on that. We're talking in February, so that's the acceptance period is still ongoing. But what spawned the special issue from seven authors from as many institutions?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is certainly something that I've been stewing about for a while. But then I think it sort of mostly came together starting in, say, maybe 2021, 2022, partly through being on Twitter a lot more during the pandemic, I became much more aware of other like-minded people. So following people like Solomon David and Katie O'Reilly, that they're excellent science communicators. There was a really interesting paper by Alec Lackman that was published in a regular issue of Environmental Biology of Fishes in the summer of 2022, looking at long-lived age and growth in long-lived quillback, and so started having conversations with the three of them about possible interest in putting together a special issue on underappreciated native fishes. And then, of course, I wanted to bring in Doug Watkinson, one of your colleagues from DFO, who I've worked with for several years on the freshwater fishes subcommittee of CSEWC, and whose knowledge of particularly Canadian prairie fishes is almost unparalleled. So yeah, it was a question of bringing together like-minded people, and they spread the word among their circles, and we're getting some really exciting papers coming in.
That's awesome. Yeah, some I hate to do this, but some gargantuan names in the field for sure. And for that, what kind of papers are you hoping to see, you and the other editors?
Yeah, so there's actually been four published online already, two on GAR, two on Red Horses. We have, I think, another eight that are in various stages of review on freshwater drum, white sucker, a couple more Red Horse and GAR papers. So definitely there's some species of interest that are being focused on, like I think smallmouth buffalo as well. So some of those, not necessarily species at risk, but more those non-game fishes that often fall through the cracks in terms of management. And then there's also a few papers in the works that also deal more specifically with the challenges of managing non-game fishes, some of the legislation around that as well.
Yeah, and on that side of, these underappreciated non-game or native fishes becoming more and more, in the limelight over the last couple of years, do you think that's a Twitter bubble, or is that, you know, management and science and even anglers kind of shifting their perspective on what these fish are valued or what their value is in the ecosystem.
Yeah, I think it's a real shift, and not just that I'm only becoming more aware of it myself. I mean, it does seem that there is a greater appreciation for biodiversity in general. And I think, you know, that might be partly due to species at risk legislation that I think is finally recognizing fish, even if they don't have an explicit economic value. But then I think it does also tie in with just better science communication. I think we often don't give the public credit for being able to or wanting to appreciate nature for nature's sake, and it is really very inspiring to see how often the public gets behind some of these outreach and conservation efforts for fish that, you know, often are referred to pejoratively as trash fish or other. That I'm hopeful that it's a real shift and not just a temporary one.
Awesome. And for your special edition, not just yours, but the Union of Editors, you know, what are your kind of hopes around the outcomes from the special edition and how that might change people's perspectives? Or is it looking for more scientists to get involved in these rough or non-game fish? Or what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Because I think our hope is to sort of raise the profile of these underappreciated fishes. These papers wouldn't necessarily not be published if we didn't have the special issue, but I think by bringing them together, it sort of helps elevate the status of them, particularly if we have some of those overarching, you know, synthesis papers that also try to put everything into perspective. And then I would say maybe not that politicians read the scientific literature or anything like that, but again, by having it sort of elevated a little bit more and a little bit more obvious, then we could use that perhaps as a platform to raise their profile a little bit more in terms of legislation and management.
Very cool. Well, Margaret, that is the hard part of the interview. We've talked about your amazing work on lampreys and figuring out if they're going to be turned into females or males. We've talked about the work at your lab. We've talked a little bit about the special edition you've got coming up. My cat is very interested to know, what are you up to when you're not working? What does Margaret do for fun when she is not raising lampreys or taking fin clips and diving into the genome?
Well, I have to admit that I am often working, but when I'm not working, I'd say my two main ways of relaxing, watching movies and TV. My daughter is studying film and television at Sheridan College, so she often motivates me. She often has a watch list for me, so I'm usually trying to keep up with her in that respect. And then my second sort of favorite thing to do is relax, is to play board games. Probably Trivial Pursuit is my top one that my daughter and I often search through Value Village's board game collections, and I buy, you know, any trivia games I can find. I think
I have to hit up that hot tip, actually. I didn't know that they had board games there, but
they do. Yeah. I think we now have well over 20 different editions of Trivial Pursuit in our collection.
That's awesome.
Yeah. No, I highly recommend it. Yeah.
So as a film fan, have you seen Blood Lake, Attack of the Killer Lamprey?
Not only have I seen it, I have, I'm sure, over the years given out at least 10 copies of the DVD to various people. Yes.
Would you recommend a viewing for the listeners of the podcast to check out?
I would highly recommend it. I would describe Blood Lake as being, if it were any better, it wouldn't be as good. But it's good because it is kind of bad. But I found it really interesting because it was almost as if they went through the Great Lakes Fishery Commission website on some of the basic biology of lampreys and tried to work all of that into the script. So there's a little bit of a nod to pheromones and various things. So
very cool.
It's a fun watch.
Well, if they need someone to consult them on the next one, the sequel, they know who to call. That's awesome. All right. And with that, Margaret, we got the final five questions here. First one, what is your favorite fish? And I'm willing to accept with and without a jaw, because I feel like you probably got one of each.
Well, I definitely have one without a jaw. I'd say my favorite fish is the pouched lamprey that's found in the southern hemisphere. It's called a pouched lamprey because the males, when they become sexually mature, develop a large gular pouch. That's not what makes them my favorite, though. What makes them my favorite is when they, after metamorphosis, when they're preparing for downstream migration to the sea, they take on this beautiful iridescent blue color. I mean, they're just gorgeous. I mean, I think they rival peacocks in terms of that, the beauty of that blue. So far and away, I'd say pouched lamprey is my favorite fish. Jawed fish? There aren't any really close seconds to lampreys.
Wow, okay.
For me. I mean, there's a lot of...
We can leave it there, Margaret.
There's a lot of jawed fish that I think are cool. I mean, I think angler fishes are cool, and I love all coral reef fish. I'm afraid that my heart lies with the jawless fishes.
All right. That's okay. All right, next question. What is your favorite memory from your career so far?
Favorite memory. Now, that's really hard to say. It's been a long career so far, and a lot of really good memories, and a lot of sort of meaningful ones. In terms of favorite memories, I have it narrowed down to two. And in both cases, when I discovered something for the first time, so I'd say the number one would be when I found out for the first time that you could actually sequence DNA. This was from learning this from Bob Devlin in 1993 at the West Van Lab. That just blew my mind. And now I know that I'm sure it's very commonplace, but learning that it could be done and learning the chemistry behind it, I thought was just amazing. And then a close second to that would be when I heard about environmental DNA for the first time, that it was both fascinating as a scientist, a little bit gross from a swimmer's point of view, knowing that when you go swimming, you're bathed in the DNA of all the fish and aquatic organisms that live in the water. But from a scientific point of view, again, that was pretty cool.
Okay, so next question then. What is your dream job or location?
Yeah, now it's going to sound kind of sappy maybe, but for dream job, I'd kind of say that I have it, it really is. I feel so fortunate, even when I'm, good naturedly griping about, the workload or this or that. I think every day I recognize how fortunate I am. I mean, I get paid to essentially pursue my own passion and satisfy my own curiosity. So, I mean, yeah, it really is a dream job. And particularly after, it took 14 and a half years to get here, I definitely don't take it for granted.
That's awesome. Yeah, your postdoc career, I think probably lots of people listening to this right now thinking that is dedication. So shout out to you, Margaret. All right. Next question. If resources weren't an issue, what is one project you'd like to work on?
Yeah, now, and fortunately, most of those questions that keep me up at night are getting answered. And so I don't have a lot, but I'm in terms of, so that, I've always said that I have sort of three questions that I want to answer before I retire or before I stop working. I guess those two things aren't necessarily the same in our business, but
we can be positive though, Margaret. Let's be positive for this one.
Sex determination in lampreys. I think we're well on our way there. The origin of sea lamprey in Lake Ontario is something that I think Yanis's work is addressing, but just to sort of give you a little bit of background to that lingering question, we've always known that sea lamprey are non-native above Niagara Falls, but the question of how long they've been in Lake Ontario was still unresolved, whether they only got into Lake Ontario in historical times in the past 200 years or so through canals, or whether they have been there for several thousand years since the last glacial retreat. So that, I think, is largely being addressed. The final outstanding question that I would want to address, if resources were unlimited, or even if resources are limited, I still want to do it, is the genetic basis for feeding type of lampreys. And so most people are familiar with the parasitic lamprey, but more than half of all lamprey species are actually non-parasitic. And by non-parasitic, I don't mean that they feed on something else after metamorphosis. It means that they don't feed at all after metamorphosis. Their gut degenerates during metamorphosis, and then they go 8 to 10 months before they spawn and die without ever feeding again, which is quite amazing. That's a long time. So that so adult non-parasitic lampreys are shorter than the largest larvae because they shrink during that time because they're living off of their body reserves while developing the gonads. What's really exciting about this, at least from an evolutionary point of view, is non-parasitic lampreys are derived from a parasitic ancestor, and in most cases they're very recently derived. And in fact, most non-parasitic lampreys occur as a pair to a parasitic counterpart. So like in Manitoba, we have the parasitic silver lamprey, and then the northern brook lamprey is its non-parasitic counterpart. They're barcode indistinguishable. And this is how I first started getting into this work, 20 years ago or so. These paired lamprey species are barcode indistinguishable, that they're genetically indistinguishable, at least with the means we have to date, as genetically indistinguishable. As larvae, they're morphologically indistinguishable. It's only at metamorphosis where they have this parting of the ways, where they become morphologically, behaviorally, and so on, very different, so that when it comes time to spawning, the parasitic ones are so much larger than the non-parasitic ones. So I'm very interested then in exploring the genetic basis for feeding type. And so this is work that we've started, and I'm hoping to be able to, within the next few years, continue this work.
Very cool. And the final question, though, Margaret, we have is, if there was one pointer principle you could have programmed in everyone's head, what would it be?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things that I can sort of think of, but in terms of trying to get into everyone's head, sort of not just within sort of the scientific community, or if I'm talking to students or something like that, and sort of in keeping with the theme of underappreciated native fishes, I'd probably say that I would want sort of everyone to be aware. And when I say everyone, I mean the public, and maybe especially politicians, the importance of sort of biodiversity as a whole in maintaining healthy ecosystems. I think we've seen too often, and maybe still, this notion that we can manage for only recreationally or commercially important fish, that they have to have a commercial value or an economic value to be important, and that everything else is trash fish. So I think I'd like to sort of get it into everyone's head that there's no such thing as trash fish.
Awesome. Well, Margaret, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. Looking forward to that special edition, which I believe comes out around the time that this podcast is going to air. So this is airing March 31st-ish.
Yeah, actually, the closing date for submissions is the end of March, and then they'll still be going through review, so that the final issue won't be published for some time. But the papers, as they're accepted, are published online, so they're available as they're published. And if there is anybody who is interested in submitting a manuscript, even if it's very close to that March 31st deadline or past that, they should reach out to me, because there's a little bit of wiggle room in that deadline if there's other papers to be submitted.
Amazing. Well, with that, thank you again, Margaret. And if you've got that last minute paper that you're thinking about submitting, you've got a couple days. So get in touch with Margaret ASAP.
Thanks for joining us on this week's episode of the Fisheries Podcast. If you'd like to get hold of me or the podcast, you can find us on socials at Fisheries Pod, or send feedback to feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app, stream on Spotify, or head to fisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget to check out our Patreon page or our Teespring store to support the show. I'm Brandon Spearin, and remember that all biodiversity matters, not just fish that have a commercial or recreational value.